This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Next on Plains FM, we have Movie Talk, a program for all things cinema-esque, for the discerning film and video junkie.
To Movie Talk. Today we'll be looking at the last days of Oscar Wilde in The Happy Prince and Dick Cheney, the influential US vice president behind George W. Bush, in Vice. We also have the top 10 films of 2018.
I was doomed from the start. Why does one run towards ruin? Why does it hold such a fascination?
Has been most intelligent. I congratulate you on the success of your performance.
What I'm saying is that I have lived in the grip of vice and pleasure.
Oscar Wilde, the sentence of the court is that you be imprisoned and kept to hard labor for 2 years.
It was wrong, and I have paid.
We'll make a Catholic of you yet.
Only unlike dear Jesus, you have luggage.
I fully intend to effect a reconciliation with my wife.
I feel sure that if I was to see him once, I would forgive him everything.
And rest assured, I shall never see Lord Alfred Douglas again.
I forbid him to live with that infernal man.
Oscar, let's run away somewhere no one could find us.
You don't know what you're saying.
Then you will never see Constance again.
Not wearing your silk stockings today, Oscar.
You go too far, sir.
No, you go too far.
Rupert Everett wrote, directed and plays the lead role of controversial poet and playwright Oscar Wilde in The Happy Prince. Carolyn Brown's been off to the Academy Cinemas at the Colombo Shopping Mall to see this multi-level portrayal of Wilde's last days. Carolyn, do you think The Happy Prince gives Oscar Wilde a fair portrayal?
As much as I hate to say it, it probably does, because I always like to have this. He's such a good writer and author, one of my favourites, so I kind of have rose-tinted glasses on when I think of him. And I think from reading the backstory and everything, I think Rupert, and it took Rupert 10 years to bring this film to fruition, and he idolises the man. So I think it probably is one of the fairest films about Oscar Wilde.
Yeah, well, Rupert Everett seems to have always had a fascination with Oscar Wilde.
Yes.
He's appeared in at least
three
Oscar Wilde's plays or films of his plays.
Yeah.
Or films about Oscar Wilde himself, another one in which he played Oscar Wilde earlier.
And he does it with lots of sensitivity because this is set in the final days of his life. And he's an outcast in Paris, basically, and well, in Paris and other places. And I think it's just, it's a beautiful period drama.
Yeah, I loved the feel of that place.
Yes.
The costuming, of course, and just those old narrow little streets in Paris and that sort of thing.
That's
a beautiful setting for
And on the coast,
but,
further down.
It captures that so beautifully. Well, I must say, Everett is gay himself, and I get that. And I think this is why he possibly has managed to add that touch to the film.
Yeah.
Understanding, just the way Oscar Wilde behaves himself.
Yeah, so was Stephen Fry.
Exactly. Well, but he's captured some of the humour or the way these characters behave in this. It's got the sort of twisted touch of humour to it.
It is.
But he's done this so well because it fits in just perfectly.
I think, as he says, the only person that, Oscar Wilde's grandson has seen the film, and the only comment he had to make was on how he died. He disagrees on what he died from. But that's not even really particularly covered. It's a little bit ambiguous in the film as well. And so for his grandson, who has access to all his memoirs and letters and everything like that, to approve of the film, it has to be a good one. I think. Unless he wants some more royalties for the foundation. Well, yeah. But anyway, Rupert Everett, he does his character well. He really gets into it. You Yeah, he wears a fat suit for it.
Oh, yes, certainly.
He had specially made, because he's done this in theatre as well. Before he made this film, he did an Oscar Wilde play.
Yeah.
Based on his life in theatre. So he knows his stuff. Mm. And this is very, you can see that he's put a lot of passion into this film.
You know, I mean, Oscar Wilde as a personality, I mean, he's a winning personality. He could con anybody over to his side. I mean, he's got this wonderful elocution, wonderful way of speaking, wonderful choice of words, you know, the way he could get all this together, and his sort of touch of witticism and humour.
He's very funny, very dry humour. If you've read any of his plays,
and it can be add that sort of added twist to what he says, like he's going on about how all these terrible things have now been, you know, he's first of all that in it, he's, we see him after he's let out of jail. Mm. He's been in jail in England for sexual indecent
behaviour.
For being
gay. He was pardoned in 2017, which is a long time. But
And he's let out. Now he's completely lost his reputation and everything, possibly even his wife he doesn't know yet and all this. So he heads off to Paris without any money.
Well, a little bit of a stipend,
But it doesn't seem to last long anyway.
Yeah.
From that you get a few flashbacks. You see he's got two sons and he's occasional flashbacks or flashes to them. Yeah. And all this kind of thing. But then he sort of, one scene there, he blames himself for this aspect of himself, you know, this sort of silly hedonist, but he leaves himself wide open. It's no wonder that he finally cops, you know, cops this and that, with his choice of people and all.
He's very much a live-in-the-moment type of a guy.
Yeah, but he says to himself, you know, that I am my own Judas.
Yes.
And that is a sort of wonderful, honest...
And I'm so glad they also quoted the line in the poem that he wrote about Reading Jail, or Reading all about how every man kills the things he loves, some with a sword or some with a pen. You can tell I'm a bit of an Oscar Wilde fan, but he does that. And Rupert Everett, you can see it in the screenplay as well, just the way that he relates the story of the Happy Prince, which is, I think, is one of Oscar Wilde's saddest stories, even though it's a children's story.
It's a children's story,
It doesn't have a happy ending, and neither does this film.
Anyway, I think this is a wonderful portrayal of the whole thing.
It is.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Carolyn Brown with her views on The Happy Prince, and I'm Hans Petrovic on Movie Talk on Plains FM 96.9. I'd like to thank the sponsor of the show, the Harcourt's Grenadier Accommodation Centre, which is now located at 98 Morehouse Avenue. If you're looking for a place to live, check out the Harcourt's Accommodation Centre website, www.assetmanagers.co.nz. That address again, www.assetmanagers.co.nz. Managers, one word, .co.nz. With me now is Ian Cumming to help me with this year's top 10 films. Ian will give us his list first, and I will then follow with mine. We will start with number 10 and work our way up to number 1.
Well, we'll start, as you say, with number 10, which is Can You Ever Forgive Me? Now, this is one of several two stories in my top 10, and it actually just snuck in, as I only saw it about 3 days ago. It's a remarkable performance by Melissa McCarthy of a failing writer who turns to forging and selling letters of famous people to make a living. And Richard E. Grant gives excellent flamboyant support. Number nine is Darkest Hour. Now, I knew this one was going to be good with its stunning opening shot, shot very high in the debating chamber, then lowering and tightening and closing in on a close-up of Churchill, played by Gary Oldman, who's quite the best so far, with quite the best so far portrayal of many actors before. Joe Wright, the director, is right on the mark here. Number eight, A Quiet Place. Now, this is a real surprise of this sleeper of a thriller, which shows Emily Blunt in sharp contrast to Mary Poppins. Director John Krasinski plays her husband as their family tread very carefully and quietly in fear of strange, deadly creatures. I'm really looking forward to A Quiet Place 2, now in production. And to number 7, American Animals. Now, deservedly getting a wider release after the film festival, it's the thrilling story of the most daring art robbery by Fort College students. Director Bart Layton, who made the brilliant The Imposter, mixes his young actors recreating the original students with the latter's recollections to camera. See You Up There is number 6, and it's the only the French, I think, can produce such an extraordinary film. It's a mix of brutal war and burlesque and black comedy and a war memorial scam. So there's full credit to the director, Albert Dupontel, who also wrote and played one of the two men, and they engineer a plot to get back to the government that cheated on returned soldiers. Number 5 is The Shape of Water. Guillermo del Toro is at his very best in this Oscar-winning, amazing film, a mix of science fiction, this romance and fantasy, which won Best Picture and Best Director. And Sally Hawkins gives a stunning and memorable performance as a mute cleaner in a top-secret government laboratory. And then we come to number 4 with this extraordinarily long title, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Also a past winner of 2 Oscars, including In Bruges, the director and writer Martin McDonagh puts an Irish take of a quintessential American story and delivers a compelling dramatic black comedy movie of a small-town prejudice, racism and misogyny. There's faultless acting from Frances McDormand. I've been a fan of hers since Fargo. Sam Rockwell, who got Best Supporting Actor, and the ever-reliable Woody Harrelson. Number 3... Bohemian Rhapsody. Well, director Bryan Singer takes a break from a string of XN movies and delivers a cracking, riveting and a pulsating story of the formation and life of Queen up to the time of Freddie Mercury's death. It's well cast, particularly Rami Malek's Freddie, and it includes an extraordinary recreation of Queen's live aid set at Wembley. Now we come to number 2, Black Klansman. The latest joint, inverted commas, from director Spike Lee, whose movies never fail to impress, and this is really impressive with another amazing true story of infiltration to the KKK by a black undercover cop in the 1970s. Denzel Washington's son John David pairs up with Adam Driver in this edge-of-the-seat, nail-biting drama. And to number 1, Sweet Country. Post-World War I, director Warwick Thornton has delivered a high noon-like western set in the unforgiving outback of Australia, where Aboriginals are treated like cattle and racism is rife. Stunning settings and photography and great acting by Sam Neill, Brian Brown and Hamilton Morris, an Aboriginal who's never made a film before. And just being pipped at the post was at Eternity's Gate, the post, the wife and the children's act.
Well, wonderful. Thank you. Let's see how many of those I've got on my list. Okay, I'll start off with number 10. That's The Children Act. Emma Thompson gives one of her best performances as a high court judge who is having difficulties with her husband, as well as with a court case involving a teenage boy who's refusing blood transfusion on religious principle. Then number 9 is Widows. Instead of a light comedy, this bank heist movie is presented as a multi-leveled social commentary set in contemporary Chicago. 4 women with nothing in common except a huge debt left behind by their dead husbands' criminal activities conspire to steal the money they urgently need. Then number 8 is The Favourite. 3 women, Olivia Colman, Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, give amazing performances in this offbeat story set in the royal court of Queen Anne in early 18th century England, where a close friend of the Queen governs the country. Another charming young woman then turns up with ambitions of taking over. Number 7 is They Shall Not Grow Old. New Zealand's Peter Jackson directed this powerful documentary about World War I with never-before-seen footage to commemorate the centennial of the end of that war earlier this year. Number 6 is Bohemian Rhapsody. The legendary rock music band Queen, its lead singer Freddie Mercury, and their dramatic music are brought to life in this powerful musical. The film ends with a reconstruction of the 1985 Live Aid concert in London, for which Queen famously reunited. Number 5 is A Star Is Born. Lady Gaga and writer-director Bradley Cooper both star in what could well be the best of the 3 film versions of this musical about a musician who helps a young singer find fame even as his own career goes on a downward spiral. Number four is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Frances McDormand won an Oscar for her portrayal of the angry, grieving mother of a girl who has been raped and murdered. The mother then challenges the local police for failing to catch the culprit. This bitter black comedy also was awarded an Oscar for Best Picture. Number three is Phantom Thread. In what is expected to be Daniel Day-Lewis's last film, the three-time Oscar winner gives us a wonderful portrayal of a renowned dressmaker in 1950s London, whose fastidious life is disrupted by a young, strong-willed woman who becomes his muse and lover. Number two is Sweet Country. Racial injustice is the theme of this powerful Australian film set in the Northern Territory in the 1920s, where an Aboriginal farmhand shoots a white man in self-defence and has to go and run when a posse gathers to hunt him down. And number one is Black Klansman. African-American filmmaker Spike Lee directs this ironic black comedy about racism in the United States. Set in 1979 and based on a true story, a black police officer in Colorado manages to successfully infiltrate the local Ku Klux Klan with surprising results. Intelligent, disturbing, and often hilarious, this film is bound to be a nominee for this year's Best Picture Oscar. Okay, well, thank you, Ian. I think we've got two or three there that are the same.
Well, we've got one and two were both the same for us.
So that's fair
apart
enough.
From that, there's some films that you haven't seen and there's films that I haven't seen.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Thank you.
What do you say? I want you to be my VP. I want you. You're my vice.
Well, George, honey, I'm a CEO of a large company. And I have been Secretary of Defense. And I have been White House Chief of Staff. The Vice Presidency is a mostly symbolic job.
Uh-huh.
However, if we came to a different understanding, I can handle the more mundane jobs. Overseeing bureaucracy, military, energy, and foreign policy.
With me now on the phone is Mary Gibson, who has been off to the Academy Cinemas at the Colombo Shopping Mall to see Vice, which turns out to be a meticulously researched film about a corrupt, bureaucratic Washington insider. Mary, this is a rather disturbing film about Dick Cheney, who quietly wielded immense power as George W. Bush's vice president. What did you think of Vice?
Oh, gosh, look, I think there are a number of things about this film. And first of all, it's deeply disturbing in terms of how much power Cheney wielded, how he went about that and what he did. But secondly, it is a very, very informative film, which I think everyone should take the opportunity to see. And thirdly, Christian Bale as Dick Cheney is unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable, how he transforms from, a young man in 1963 through to the later era.
Well, he's only about 44 at the most, something like that,
Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal. I found this film really interesting, but also, as you said, deeply disturbing in terms of what transpired, what took place. And when you realise that the Americans effectively started the war on Iraq because they hadn't found who had been responsible for the 9/11 attacks, so it was, they'd actually created this persona of, a radical extremist Muslim, which in the end established ISIS. You just kind of go, oh my gosh, the Americans are so quick to blame everyone and to criticize and critique, but behind the scenes, this was just very, very disruptive, disturbing, and an incredibly important piece of history. And when you understand that, you're actually in shock and disbelief, aren't you, in terms of the content of the movie?
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, the interesting point is that Dick Cheney was the CEO of Halliburton, and that's on the top oil field service companies. And then he moved on to become vice president. And that's why I was so interested for the Americans to move into Iraq and take over the oil fields there and that sort of thing. And he managed to achieve that and in the process upset the Middle East to what the turmoil that is there today, which is affecting... Yeah,
exactly. And not only that, he was the CEO of Halliburton, which was providing services to the United States government at incredibly exorbitant costs. And when he stepped down as CEO, because George Bush asked him to be his running mate and vice president, and Cheney set his own terms, he got a $26 million severance payout. That is just unbelievable. You know, and so when you look at that, it's so incredibly corrupt, and that whole corruption that was going on behind the scenes, but also the fact that they didn't tell Bush. They basically just did, and they did him, Cheney, his lawyer, and a couple of other cronies developed a way to circumnavigate any critique or any audit process and basically made their own decisions about everything. That was just unbelievable, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, the position of vice president in the before that was did not have much power. I mean, he was a sort of a figure who stood in quietly in the background. But Cheney changed that completely, and he took over from the things that and the decisions that George Bush Jr. should have been making, and he decided these things and actually managed to push them through. You know, and this unfortunately, I think this is what has eroded the American people's trust in their own government a lot. And this is what we feel more now. This is the, you know, now it's typified by Trump, but this was developing, you know, from the time of Dick Cheney. Yeah, it's very unfortunate.
Exactly, yeah. But the other interesting thing was that he was neither a Democrat or a Republican. He just decided on which political agenda he would follow to suit his own needs and where he'd get the most traction. But also when you look today, you know, and Trump saying, let's make America great again, that actually goes back to Cheney. And that's what's really interesting. You know, you heard that saying then in the movie, and I'm like, holy heck, that's what, you know, Trump is just parroting everything that goes back to that era. Let's start a war, let's do this, let's do that. You know, it's just unbelievable. But I think if we take away the fact that it is a very, very important piece of political history and worldwide history, and look at the movie in the way it was made, the way it was structured, is really interesting as well, in that there's a narrative going on, and the narrative is by this man who ends up being the person that gives a heart, because Cheney's got a faulty heart, a heart to Cheney. And so you kind of go, oh, so part of me was saying throughout the movie, oh, Cheney's actually got a heart. Oh, that's right, it's someone else's heart. You know? And
that's such an odd commentator throughout the film. You keep on wondering throughout the film who it is. And the film in many places is full of comedy. It is a funny film. They play it for laughs. Oh, well, a satire, let's say. But, I mean, to me, in many ways, this is too serious a subject to treat it in a funny way. But nevertheless, it's a powerful movie.
Yes, very much so.
And disturbing.
Very, very much so, and I really recommend people see it.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Mary. That was Mary Gibson with her views on Vice, and I'm Hans Petrovic on Movie Talk on Plains FM 96.9, saying goodbye until midday next Wednesday.